vineyard, and he came seeking fruit on it and found none. Then he said to the keeper of his vineyard, "Look, these 3 years I've come seeking fruit on this fig tree and find none. Cut it down. Why does it use up the ground?" Here again we see the same two factors, the goal and the variable. He answered and said to them, "Sir, let it alone this year also until I dig around it and fertilize it. And if it bears fruit, well, but if not, after that you shall cut it down." So what was the issue? What was it that Christ was seeing or not seeing that determined his feeling, the husbandman command regarding the tree? The presence of fruit. Was the tree healthy? We have no indication that it wasn't extremely healthy. Probably had huge, branches of rich green foliage. But what was he interested in? Fruit. He says this tree is designed to bear fruit. By virtue of the fact it's got this luxuriant growth and no fruit, it is using incredible amounts of resources that are taking away from the ability of the trees next to it to produce fruit. Get rid of it. So the steward says, "Sir, let me give me one more year. What's he going to do? Let me see if I can work with the suitability of the soil. And maybe it'll produce fruit." The goal and the issue, the end result, is still fruit. But one of the things that keeps being woven in here is the suitability of the soil. Find in Matthew 9:37, then he said to his disciples, "The harvest is truly plentiful, but the laborers are few. Therefore, pray the Lord of the harvest that he will send out laborers into his harvest." What's the focus of a harvest? Crop, fruit, bringing in production what's the other thing about a harvest? What makes a harvest, as opposed to just going out and cutting stuff? When do you harvest? When it's ripe. I ask such profound questions, don't I? It's hard to lower yourself to that level of simplicity. But I need some help in those things sometimes. San Joaquin Valley in California produces well over 50% of the entire United States vegetables. That whole industry would absolutely collapse if it were not for the migrant Mexican workers that come up from the South. In the last 10 years, 20 years, whatever, they have organized into a union, agricultural union, led by a not too well-liked in many quarters man named Cesar Chavez. You may be familiar with his name. When does Cesar Chavez strike? January? No. Cesar Chavez does not go on strike in January. He does not make his threats in January. He makes them about June 15th. And he generally gets all or part. Now, it's a game, so he asks for more than he knows he's going to get. And they back and forth, everybody saves face. But he knows that his power is in harvest because that's when the laborers are needed. All right, so we see some of the basic things that we really need to keep in our focus. We've got the stewardship principle as far as governing our motivation. As far as our strategy, it seems that Christ is quite clear when he gives us and spends the time and the emphasis that he does on the agricultural or the harvest model. Now again, historically, we look at ourselves, we see we did not have a harvest model. We had a remnant or a proclamation model wherein we would proclaim outward, but whether there was a harvest or not was not important to us. What was measured as success was how well we shouted, not who listened or even more importantly, what they did about what they heard. Okay. Again, I've made a little diagram here. We have a harvest. You've got these mango orchards. I did this for the Spaniards, and I like mangoes, and they grow them down in Mexico. And so I use mangoes instead of apples or kiwis or something. But anyway, you've got these orchards, okay? And you've got your foreman out scouting, and you've got one of your orchards, and it's green. I mean, there's just nothing right. Now the Filipinos ruined me by saying, "Well, we like green mangoes," so shot me down, but. The Mexicans don't like green mangoes, so I was all right. Nobody brought it up. But you've got one. I mean, it's just unripe. It's green. They're not ready. You can send somebody in there all day long, and all they're going to do is ruin your your economics if they start picking. Now you've got another orchard further down, and it's situated where it gets sunshine and breezes in such a way that they're more ripe. You could send your workers in there and put them to work, and they would be able to pull out of there about 1 kilo of fruit for about 5 hours labor, because they got to go right up to the top of the trees, they've got the sunlight, and hand pick them, and careful not to destroy the other fruit, etc. Then you've got this other field, and that's located in a broad, sunny area next to the river, and warm breezes protecting from the chill, etc. And that, you estimate that in that orchard, you can produce 5 kilos per man hour. Okay, where are you going to send your laborers if you are interested in producing fruit? Well, you're going to send them for the harvest, aren't you? And where's the harvest? Well, the best harvest is going to be at five kilos per hour. Okay? Now, you're the husbandman, you're the steward, etc. Are you going to send anybody to the others? Are you going to take everybody to the 5 kilos per hour? Are you going to have anybody in the all-green orchard? Dan's not. Anybody would? I would. Why would I have somebody there? Yeah, I want somebody there to keep from having instant insect attack. I want somebody there to tell me, I want somebody there that says, hey, we're up at 5 kilos an hour in this orchard, get the troops over here. But, you know, you're kind of like one of those guys. Actually, we have a congregation, so it doesn't count, but the guys in Thailand would be, you know, Aaron and Rhonda are kind of the, they're in the all-green orchard. And they're telling us, hey, you know, we have some potential action over here. Hey, that's greener than all get out over there. Just forget it. But we're not ignoring. So it's not like we say, you're not worth anything. Because is there going to be a change? Yes, there's going to be a change. There's going to come a time when we've picked that orchard clean. There's going to come a time when the 5 hours for 1 kilo becomes the 5 kilos for 1 hour, maybe. Or maybe it never gets beyond 2 kilos per hour in terms of what that particular orchard will produce. But certainly this all green is not going to stay the same. They may have a typhoon come through and blow them all off and you have zero. Or it will ripen and become possibly 6 kilos per hour. So we have a responsibility to the whole field. But where do we send our laborers? Where do we invest our resources? If the agricultural model is something Christ intended us to understand, and if he was saying, my interest is that you invest my resources for my glory, and he expects production, now he'll determine how great or how little. You know, I don't think we're ever going to become a mega church in the sense of competing with the Catholics or the huge Protestant. I don't think that's going to be the case or possible, because committed Christians generally aren't, you know, people aren't that attracted to what being a committed Christian is all about. But I think there's a lot more growth that God would have for us than we have taken advantage of, because I think we've ignored certain principles and taken or not allowed certain tools in our box, or maybe not known we had them, and therefore we may have been dividing our forces in a way that was not aiming strictly at the harvest. So certain conditions are better suited to produce a bountiful crop than others. Okay, when you need the most labors is during the harvest, when things are ripe. Now, when we apply this spiritually, what are we talking about? When is there ripeness in our field or in our orchard? How would we determine ripeness? Christ at one point said, looked up, this was in John 4 as well, he was talking about Samaria, and he said, you know, he said, pray the Lord of the harvest. That wasn't John 4, I'm sorry, John 6. Pray the Lord of the harvest. Did he send laborers? It's white with harvest. Why did he say that? The group that he was talking about proceeded shortly thereafter to become harvested. There were others that were not available. Let's take a look. Next slide. These 12 Jesus sent out and commanded them, saying, do not go into the way of the Gentiles, and do not enter a city of the Samaritans, but go rather to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. And whatever city or town you enter, inquire who in it is worthy, and stay there till you go out. And whoever will not receive you nor hear your words, good spelling on your, when you depart from that house or city, shake off the dust from your feet. Now, again, we've tended to look at this from a U.S. and B.C. paradigm, so we've placed great weight on lost sheep of House of Israel, and we have taken this from an approach of this, racially speaking, is whom should be gone to, and the other should not be gone to for racial purposes. Christ's model is more agricultural in terms of what's ripe and what's not what brand of mango you are. Okay? I think we've commented already on the lost sheep of House of Israel anyway. You notice, though, he mentions where to go and where not to go. Subsequently, did they go to the Samaritans? Yes, John 4 is where he initiated evangelism with the Samaritans. Did a tremendous amount of preparation. Later in Acts, when Philip went there, the whole cotton-picking place believed. It says in mass. Christ had already laid the groundwork with some of the leadership, planted ideas that had continued to roll around among that group of people. And when Philip went there and preached the gospel, boom, he baptized nearly the whole place. What about the Gentiles? Was it God's will to go to the Gentiles? Yes. Was that the time? No. Why? The resources weren't there, the labors weren't there, and the harvest wasn't ripe. What was ripe right then? Where did Christ want it to start? Right there. Judea. Where did it go next? Samaria. Where did it go from Samaria? Well, via Antioch and the persecution that spread people out, it then skipped all over the Roman world and Asia Minor later on. We're talking here about an issue of soil receptivity, or spiritual, in this case, receptivity. Again, you know, Jesus, he said to start 5 kilo per hour at that point, that he said that were the Jews. The 5 hours for 1 kilo were the Samaritans. It's not time. The Gentiles at that point were all green. Acts 17, now when they had passed through Amphipolis and Apollonia, they came to Thessalonica, where there was a synagogue of the Jews, and Paul, as his custom was, went into them, and for 3 Sabbaths reasoned with them from the Scriptures. We find that Paul, same thing, Amphipolis, was essentially the all-green orchard. You read the account, Apollonia was more receptive, but nothing like Thessalonica, where he went and concentrated, because that's where there was receptivity. With that in mind, I'd like to show you, like to discuss Paul's strategy for a moment here. I'm going to come back to that. Let me skip ahead of myself. There we are. I want to show you this chart first. Because when we talk about soil suitability, the ability to produce a crop that's 100-fold, or one that's going to wither, or one that won't even sprout, or whatever, we essentially are talking about an issue of resistance versus receptivity. Now, you can take every human being on the earth, and they're going to fall. Boy, that's really looks like it could use some focusing. Not that way. No, sorry about that. Maybe it can be hand-adjusted, but it's not going any further. No. Anyway, everybody on earth fits somewhere on that chart. That's much better. Thank you. Right, that's got it. Between those who are highly resistant, highly antagonistic, some have reason, some have knowledge, and some don't, and others are clear up to strongly favorable. Now, this is not talking about whether or not God is going to actually call them into his family right now, whether he's going to draw them or not. This is just talking about where they are in their natural state. There are people, like in Korea, the whole nation is extremely receptive. You can go in there and speak about religious things, and they are interested in hearing. Ukraine went from being extremely closed and resistant with the fall of communism to becoming extremely receptive. So individuals and nations and groups of people shift back and forth over time. This is not something that's set in stone. And there are factors that affect it. Now, I'll come back to this, but with that in mind, let me back up, and I want to discuss Paul's strategy a little bit. What was Paul's goal? Top half there, you see, I just redid the 4 steps. The people, it was Paul and his band of helpers, mentored and sent out by the Antioch church, and of course, backed by the whole church in Jerusalem. Motivation,
all in the same motivation we do. Plus the fact that Christ manifested himself to him and told him he better do it. That helps. We haven't had that. What was his goal? Same as ours. Make disciples, but there was a finer point to it. What was Paul's specific goal? What kind of disciples was Paul interested in making? Gentiles. So Paul's specific goal was make Gentile disciples. Is it possible with Gentiles? So where did he go to do that? To Jerusalem? No, he went to his strategy is he went to Gentile cities. Now, second chart shows how he looked at and analyzed the issue of receptivity and resistance, soil suitability or fertility versus lack of, to decide how he invested resources. First of all, let's talk about Paul. Who was Paul? Paul was a Roman citizen. So he had free rite of passage and acceptance and could function within the culture of the Roman world, could he not? Secondarily, Paul was Benjamite, but he was seen as a Jew, and he was a Pharisee. He had the highest credentials, having sat at the feet of Gamaliel. He had initial acceptance in almost any Jewish society anywhere. What was Paul trying to do? He was trying to reach people that God wanted to call in the Gentile world. Where did he start? Interesting strategy. First of all, this circle on the bottom left is a diagram of the typical makeup of a synagogue in a Gentile area. Okay? The majority, and of course the real power in the synagogues, were made up of Jews. These were Jews living all over the Roman world. They held the control. They were the true sons of Abraham by birth. They held the scriptures, etc. Now, you had, in addition to the Jews, though, in the synagogue community, you had a group of people known as proselytes. What was a proselyte? What made a proselyte a proselyte? They had taken fully, 100%, conversion to Judaism with all of its tenets, all of its practices, including circumcision, no matter how old they were, and they lived and practiced Judaism exactly the same as the Jews, complete with, you know, take it at the proper point in time, kosher kitchens and curly locks and black coats, you know, and tuck your pants into your socks and etc. These proselytes were not Jews racially. They were Gentiles. They came originally from a Gentile culture. Coming from a Gentile culture and making as radical change as they did, and now imagine them standing between the two cultures, the Jewish culture on one side, because it really is a culture. Judaism is a culture as much as a religion. And the Gentile culture from which they originated, and put them in the middle and tell me, which direction were the proselytes facing? Toward which and away from which? They were facing the Jewish, and their back turned on the Gentile. All right. Now, also, a part of the synagogue community, far, you know, given less esteem by the synagogue, tolerated, sometimes appreciated, but certainly not counted as being worthy in the same way as the Jews or the proselytes, was another group of people that we'll call, typically called, the God-fearers. That's a term that comes clear on through to the Anabaptists and others who were given that term. What were the God-fearers? How did they differ from everybody else? What was their culture of origin? Were they Jews or Gentiles? Gentiles. Well, what made them different than a proselyte? Proselytes were Gentiles. Why did they attended the synagogue? They adhered to the synagogue because they believed in certain aspects wholeheartedly. The Sabbath, one God, the true God, etc., etc., etc. Why weren't they proselytes then? Because they had not gone all the way and embraced the culture of Judaism. They still, whether they fully embraced or stayed partially in touch with their culture. Consequently, they were not worthy. They didn't make the full commitment, turn their back on their culture, be circumcised, go through all the ritual, etc. But the Jews let them attend because they shared the beliefs, in basic beliefs, and they were wholehearted. So if we put them, now the God-fearers, and here's the two cultures, which way were they facing? Well, probably kind of sideways to both. Or facing Jewish looking back at the Gentile, or facing Gentile looking back at Jewish. We can put them however we want. But it wasn't like the proselytes. We are talking here incredible receptivity. Paul learned a lot. If you look in Acts 11 and study that chapter, you see that Paul probably learned a great deal of his strategy for how he went about preaching the gospel in his journeys. He probably learned that in Antioch to a large degree, or at least perfected it into a system by virtue of what happened there. I don't have time to digress on that right now. But here's Paul. Now, what's his approach? What's Paul's typical approach? Where does he come first when he comes into a Gentile city? He goes to the synagogue. Does he have access to the synagogue? Yes, immediate access. First of all, the synagogue climate is such that it lets other, you know, it's not just like we are, a pastor. Nobody'd come into our church and stand up and say, I'd like to give the sermon today. Well, fine and dandy, you know. Go to AC. Wait 8 years. Be a trainee. No. In the synagogue, somebody, a responsible male, could get up and begin to read. So Paul had access to being able to reach people. And by virtue of his credentials, he was immediately given esteem and respect. So he walked in. Not only did they let him read, but it's, woo, this is Paul of Tarsus, or Saul of Tarsus. Okay? So they got up, and he preached. Somewhere between 1 and 3 weeks, what was the process? What was the progress? Typical procession of events. Between 1 and 3 weeks, what happened? Jews were ready to kill him, or tried. See, they looked at the outward. He had the credentials, but he had a different message, and he got up and gave it, and the Jews got mad. Sometimes it was, what? You know, I don't know if I heard that. Next week it's, yeah, I did hear that. Third week, let's stone the guy. Get out of here. let's just say we had an average of 3 weeks. At the end of 3 weeks, what happened? Paul got kicked out. The door into the synagogue slammed shut. What was he left with? Did very many Jews follow him? Some. Very few. Kind of like the green orchard, you know. Did some proselytes follow? Yes. They had their own, you know, they had a greater window of suitability by virtue that they weren't as enmeshed in Judaism as the others. So he had a little bigger group of proselytes. But who were the ones that formed the nuclei for the churches in Asia Minor? It was the Gentiles who were around and a part of, but not directly in the synagogue. And so your typical congregation had the bulk of God-fearers, a lesser number of proselytes, and an even lesser number of Jews. And then the churches grew from there. Now, what's interesting about the about the God-fearers is, in terms of these three, okay, first of all, Paul's goal is to make Gentile disciples. Of those three people, groups rather, considering that goal, which group has the strongest bridges into the Gentile community? The God-fearers. The door is open and the bridges are still there. They have not gone, they have not totally cut themselves off, no pun intended, from their original culture. See? So, the gospel continued to spread deeper and deeper into the Gentile community because of the fact that the God-fearers still had bridges of kinship and communication into their society. And so the word spread and disciples were made. You find that scenario developed again and again and again in the book of Acts. Paul understood and used the agricultural model, and he was sensitive to the issue of receptivity and resistance, and he put his resources, he went to harvest where the crop was ripe, where people were receptive. Okay. Boy, that's covered a great deal of ground there. Now, Paul's typical approach was that he went into an area and that he sought this area of receptivity, and he preached until enough fruit was born that there was a nucleus, generally a church or a cluster of churches. Then he stayed with them. He didn't just he concentrated on developing strong leadership and creating a stable situation rather than just staying there and overseeing them directly. He had a greater vision than that, and he immediately began to his emphasis was on training others to be able to do that, and then he moved on to the next area. When he had mentored a stable leadership group in that area, then he would continue to come back as he was able and to encourage and further instruct and set things straight if need be, and kind of maintain an oversight and continue to mentor and write them letters, encourage and carry on a relationship with the congregation through the leadership in that manner. Notice how Paul in his letters always goes through the leadership. Okay, that's important if we get time later on. All right, let's go back now and examine more carefully several principles which we saw here. The two principles that I want to concentrate on are, first of all, people groups, and secondarily, receptivity and resistance. Now, I don't know if some people have told me they had heard a tape that I'd given entitled Ponte Ta Ethne, where I talked about families and how God works through families. I don't know how many of you got that on the edification tape circuit and may have already heard this. How many have? Okay. I will still mention it then. If you look in Matthew 28:19-20, where it says that we go and make disciples of all nations, that term in Greek is Ponte Ta Ethne. The word that's translated nations in most translations, English translations, ethne, is not actually talking primarily about geographical political boundaries, the river such and such that divides these two countries. That's not the kind of nations it's talking about. It's talking about ethne, which we all recognize as being the derivative of words like ethnicity, etc., and would probably be better rendered, in fact, a couple translations do render it, go and make disciples of all peoples. Okay? So, again, if you look in, you see that Barnabas, in part, was chosen to go to Antioch when there was a problem there, because the problem was a Gentile problem that was erupting. And Barnabas was able to function and communicate, being a Cypriot, in a Gentile culture as well as the Jewish. He was multicultural. What's the first thing he did when he got there? Whoa, I need help. He went and got another bicultural person, someone able to function cross-culturally, being Saul of Tarsus, brought him down, and they worked through that problem there together. And, of course, the church responded and grew tremendously. They were sensitive to the fact that God tends to work through families on the literal sense and also on the expanded sense. And that there's a certain commonness in a particular group of people. Let me give you an industry definition of people group. Now, another term for this, if you want to write it down, the technical term for this is homogeneous unit, sometimes abbreviated HU, homogeneous unit. That in dealing with, especially if you're talking to brethren or non-professionals about, that's such a confusing term, unnecessary. People group makes as much sense, and it really says it. Let me give you a definition of a people group. Please don't try to copy this because it's about a paragraph. I will give you a sentence that I'll read slowly that you can copy if you want to. What then exactly is a people group? A people group is a significantly large grouping of individuals who perceive themselves to have a common affinity for one another because of their shared language, religion, ethnicity, residence, occupation, class or caste, situation, or possibly combination of these. Okay, I'll read that again. A people group is a significantly large grouping of individuals who perceive themselves to have a common affinity for one another because of their shared language, religion, ethnicity, residence, occupation, class or caste, situation, or combination of these. There tends to be a special vocabulary developed, whether it's a different language or whether it's like us. You know, we in one sense could be called a people group. We have our own vocabulary. P, T, C, C, W, N, G, N, U, B, F, O, T, first T, 2T, 3T, TOT. We can talk all day to each other and somebody else says, huh? So that's why we say we're not always talking about an ethnic group, although they certainly would be the largest people group factor. Okay, from the standpoint of communicating the message of Christ, now here's a definition if you want to write down. It is, quote, the largest group within which the gospel can flow along natural lines. The largest group within which the gospel can flow along natural lines without encountering barriers of understanding or acceptance. Without encountering barriers of understanding or acceptance due to culture, language, geography, etc. Without encountering barriers of understanding or acceptance due to culture, language, geography, etc. Everybody got that? Or you need me to? Anybody need me to read it again? Okay. I'm going to continue reading now. I'd recommend you not try to keep copying. Notice that this definition emphasizes the things a group of people hold in common. That's the key. What things are in common, and where are the barriers, and what are they? A group of people hold in common and that act as boundaries which set this group apart from other groups. Of course, individual members within any social group often differ from one another in many ways. How they look, how they dress, in preference for certain foods, sports, and hobbies. The point of our definition is that there are certain overarching similarities, such as those named above, that cause all individuals to feel at home in one group as opposed to another. Now, you can look, and we can take this. We can take the simple, simplistic approach. We could say, well, yes, we've got black people, white people, red people, yellow people. Now, those would certainly be broad definitions of different people groups where there are barriers culturally, linguistically, etc. Okay, we can take the white people, or let's take the black people. We can say American blacks versus Nigerians versus Bahamians. Are there going to be different cultures? You bet you. All black people are not going to. The gospel is not going to flow through all black people. Let's take Australians. Okay, let's just take Australia. Now that's an F. See, go to all nations. Okay, we're going to get the gospel to Australia. We're going to get the word out. Are all Australians going to accept culturally? Are there going to be barriers? Sure. What are some of them? I mean, I've only been here twice, and I've never gotten past the hotel and Sabbath service hall in Perth, and this little patch of real estate right here between here and the airport. I went to Brisbane this time for Sabbath services. Slept part way, so I missed. But I mean, that's my extent of firsthand knowledge of Australian culture. The rest of it was gained at Brickett Wood, and I think that was suspect. Okay, so I would say quickly, yes, you've got an Aboriginal ethnic group. Now I'm going back to the first level. That's obvious, different color, obviously different backgrounds. I don't think you're going to try to reach an Aborigine using the same tools, the same approach, same words, same ideas as you would the average post-convict settlement Australian. Okay, within that though, are there other people groups? What would they be? What would a few of them be? Just help me out a little bit. Migrants? Migrants versus what? Non-migrants? New Australians. All right. Where's the barrier? What's the barrier? Okay. European culture versus less European culture. Okay. Europeans too broad. Yeah. Is the gospel going to flow without hindrance among that group in terms of acceptance? Now, you see, I'll give you a couple examples. You take, for instance, the work in Canada. Okay. We have got a group of people, a sizable in certain parts of the country, that come from a Hutterite. They're former Hutterites. Hutterites are without a doubt a people group. They have certain things in common, such as a dialect, such as food, such as standards of what's right and wrong, such as communal sharing of property, that form barriers to anybody from the outside who does not share those things that tries to communicate with them. Somebody comes in there from Southern California and says, hey, you know, let's go do our thing. And they say, yeah, out with you. We don't do our thing. We do our collective thing. Totally different. Even if they spoke the same language, there'd be tremendous differences. My father, of course, the Mennonites are, now see, they would have certain internal differences, but nonetheless, the gospel could probably jump from Hutterite to Mennonite quite easily because there's certain barriers that aren't there and commonalities that are. My father went down to Mexico one time, just was curious. The German plain truth was going, several of them, into this one little village. So he rented a car and drove 100 and some miles down and drove over a hill into this little valley, and here was this village, and I mean, he thought he was going back to his childhood. There were kids walking along in overalls, blonde hair, and bare feet, shuffling through the streets. They looked just like he did when he was a kid. He got out and spoke to one of the people on the street, and it was boom, they understood him. It was like he was back in his hometown. He'd never met these people. Now, if we were going to proclaim the gospel to those people, would we send Felipe Neri from Mexico City, or would you send somebody like my dad in there and say, go talk to your kin? You see the commonality versus the barriers. Interestingly enough, I haven't checked this, but I would be willing to wager that if we did check it, we'd find that Hutterite influx into the church occurred within a roughly 5 to 7 year period, the vast majority of it, and that the rest that followed has been a trickle, but that the flood came within a 5 to 7 year period, because that's about the maximum window of time from the time that you're converted or that you're called and you begin blabbing to all your relatives and friends trying to convert them, that it takes for your whole group of people that know you to either decide that you know what you're talking about or write you off or tell you to shut up, and you do so. And so your window kind of closes over generally a 3 to 7 year period. Depending how aggressive, I guess. Okay. So it can be ethnic. It can be along other bases as well. And the issue of receptivity, suitability, how to reach them, strategy, they all roll together. The issue of a group of people. Okay, let's take Melbourne. You've got, what, the largest or second largest collection of Greeks in Melbourne? Third in the world. That's a people group. If you are a non, you know, would a non-Greek or Greek have a better shot at communicating with those people? If they're Greek and they, I mean, look, let's face it, some of the things we chuckle at Dr. Stavenides is because he thinks different than most of the rest of us. You have to read about the culture or live there. I lived in Cyprus. I can identify certain things that I hear Dr. Stavenides say or approaches he takes that he doesn't think anything about. You may just think that's just an idiosyncrasy. It's coming right out of Cyprus. For instance, I'll give you one today. Don't laugh at him now. But he says, you know, we say and things like that. You hear this little thing Doc says sometimes. It's kind of like, well, that's a Greek term. In Cyprus, every guy I went to school with, they'd say, hey, what do you want? Ray. You know, I thought, call me Ray. My name's not Ray. It means, it's the filler word. It's the Ray, you know? And so, he doesn't even know it. It's like, that's it, you know? He's not even aware, but you listen, and you'll hear him, he'll make a point and say, so it's this, Ray, you know? That's Greek. That's part of his culture. Somebody who's from that, they hear him and they say, wow, a brother. Are they going to listen? Are they going to give him an ear? Just like Paul into the synagogue. Immediate acceptance. May not stay that way. They may not like your message. But you see what I'm saying? Your suitability, your soil suitability, tends to be better. Okay. American Indians. Who are arguably the worst possible people group to try to evangelize the American Indians? That's right, the cowboys. Exactly. And they have tried for centuries, and they've got these pitiful little schools, you know, and a few kids come in there, and everybody hates them, and it's kind of this, we tolerate each other. You know who is absolutely tearing the American Indian population upside down in terms of conversion to Christianity? The Koreans. The Koreans. Asian missionaries are coming into the United States to evangelize the American Indian. Do you know, Soviet Union falls, Asia opens up, you know who is reaching a previously hostile people, you know, the Mongolians, the Chinese, forget it. They're not going to, you know, they're not going to get anywhere. The Russians, ha, that's as bad as the Chinese. Americans, well, so-so. American Indians. The Mongolians look at the American Indians as being their children, you know. They left us and went across the Bering Straits and migrated into Washington, and they're our family. American Indians come over there and preach Christianity to the Mongolians. They're converting by the hordes. There is, in other words, there is... Oh. Sorry. Culturally appropriate, yes. One aspect of people group we don't commonly think of, and I'm certainly not recommending that this ought to be our focus for where we direct our resources, but if you even take gang members, right? That gang becomes a family. There's a unique set of outer trappings. There's a unique way of thinking. There's a unique and accepted and highly institutionalized vocabulary, you know, even with their scrawl with paint cans all over. That's all very okay. If you are within that group, any kind of information, whether it's spiritual or whether you're trying to get across a political point or whatever, is going to flow unhindered far more than if you are outside that group and try to get it across. Does that mean that people outside cannot ever deal with somebody that's not of them? No, not at all. But can they deal with a person, or can they deal with that group in the way they deal with their own? Not effectively. Not effectively. You guys have been grumping along for years about how certain things we do are so American and just doesn't work over here, you know. So I assume you know that already. Now, could we send you to South Africa and you just go be an Aussie over there and do things the Aussie way and get through to most of those people? Well, didn't work for Peter. I don't know why it should work for... interesting, you see people, for instance, people groups can be embedded within people groups. Hong Kong, case in point. I'm over there, and here is, we're walking along, and of course, you know, Chinese, I should have Mr. Yang and Mr. Lo speak some. It's so beautiful and flowing. Now, if I try to imitate the sound, it sounds like a sing-song, but you know, it's kind of, it to me, it reminds me of somebody strolling and just enjoying a leisurely stroll on a nice day, you know, just kind of. Well, Tagalog, on the other hand, to me sounds very staccato, almost like a clacking, clack, 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 clack. Well, you know, the Philippine staccato, Tagalog dialogue. We're walking along in Hong Kong. That's a Sunday morning. Some of the shops are open. People are strolling. We're looking window shopping. We'd never been in this part of town, didn't know where we were. And of course, the ambient noise and conversation around is, people are talking. I'm not paying attention, but suddenly I notice something's different. We've crossed a few blocks and are down a hill, and all of a sudden I hear clack, 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 clack. I think, what's different here? I think, whoa, the sound is different. This sounds like something different. Sounds like Tagalog. And we go into Wendy's, and I'm talking with somebody there. He says, oh yeah, this is the Philippine Quarter. And he says, it's a holiday. He said, everybody's gathering. Go in the parks. And it's just like the Mexican community in Los Angeles, you know. Who's filling the parks on Sunday? They are. 100 people in a group, 10 people in a group, they don't care. Just everybody having a good time, talking together, singing, eating, drinking beer. We cross over into a park and it's full of Filipinos. Clack, clack, clack. The whole park. Clack, 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 clack. And we go out of the park and clack, clack, down a couple blocks. And pretty soon, oh, yeah. Now, there's about, what, 175,000, 200,000, whatever, Philippine guest workers in Hong Kong right now. I think it was 175,000 last time I checked, the last time I saw a stat. Okay, they are a group within a group. If you want to, you know, provided, if that group is receptive, you don't reach them the same way you'd reach the Chinese community. And ideally, who would be the best to reach them if it's available? Well, it would be someone from within their own community. Okay, so one of our strategies, and this is what you'll be reading more about what we're doing in French Africa. One of our strategies in French Africa is that we, as quickly as possible, are going to train people who are within a particular cultural group to turn around and preach to their own cultural group. We're not going to try from the outset to send in Western people to do the preaching, and then, oh, by the way, maybe down the line we'll get some. No, we're going to trust the fact that if God's calling, these people are, you know, some of these leaders are very converted men, and they've been converted men by themselves without any church or without any oversight, etc., for sometimes 15 years, then maybe within their own culture they indeed can be leaders. And if we give them the training and the nurturing they need, let God use them to turn around and have that immediate acceptance and entrance within their own culture. And when you do that within a receptive culture such as Benin or Togo, I verily believe we are going to grow. We're going to grow. It's interesting. I did a study of my church area for a particular class I was taking, and I had to do a statistical study. So I chose my brother's area in Seattle. I got statistics out of the library, and then when I was finished, I had to call him and tell him what I'd found. So I was talking with him. It was interesting that one of the things though that causes receptivity tends to be migration and the movement of people. Tends to affect their recent. There was a strong Asian population, particularly the Philippines. Philippines is a fairly receptive. We've known that for years. The Philippines is a receptive, spiritually receptive nation. They will listen to spiritual things. They'll listen to you talk about the Bible. They'll come and hear. Now, God may or may not be calling them, but that's they will have that basic interest. There's a community of them in Seattle, and I statistically had identified that. Without my brother knowing what I was doing, or me having talked to him about it before, when I was discussing it with him, I said, "Well, how is your church growing?" He said, "Well," he said, "a little." He said, "Not like I'd like." He said, "You know, doctrinal changes, everything is kind of flat. People leaving, some coming in." But he said, "You know, I've got one strong area of growth." He said, "It's kind of interesting." I said, "What's that?" Well, he said, "The strongest area of my growth is the Filipinos." He said, "I got Filipinos coming in left and right." I said, "Funny about that. It's interesting." The issue of receptivity, soil suitability, people groups, they are not something that humans have gone out and made up. We may be just coming to realize ourselves. Others have already realized it, even if they may not have, you know, even if they may not be leading people to the full truth. But nonetheless, they are biblical in origin. The agricultural principle, the agricultural model is something Christ gave, fully intending that we hear and understand it. And the working through people, we have always known that, but we've never put it as a tool in our kit. We've had it aside as something we understand, but never as a strategy, never as a tool in our kit. Looking at issues of receptivity and targeting our people, or targeting our resources to a receptive area, leaving the green orchard, having somebody keep an eye on it, and pulling heavy troops into it when it becomes ripe, is not something we've had as a tool in our kit. Because our paradigm was blast everybody and see who responds. And of course, we're here because we, you know, God led us to respond. But if we follow His model and we invest our resources in a manner in accordance with that model, should we not expect, according with His will, as the master and we the stewards, that He would give us a greater profit, a greater crop? I think we will find that, again, within the limitations of where He wants to work and what societies are doing, that will be the case. I defined a people group. Now, I'd like to come back to this resistance and receptivity for one moment. I just passed it. Because, again, I'd like to kind of talk about two levels. I think when I talk about receptivity and resistance without defining it, I'm talking about general societal resistance to spiritual things. I am not talking about the specific drawing by God through the Holy Spirit of a person to His church. Okay? But we need to acknowledge that there are both factors at work. Obviously, nobody is going to come to the body of Christ without being drawn through the Spirit of God. And that is a divine act, and it is a sovereign right and function of God and no human. We don't know where He's doing that. We don't know when He's doing it until generally it's already underway, right? So we have to go to all people, and we have to go not knowing who he's drawing and who he's not. So where do we look as far as a place to start? Okay, this much broader general area of resistance or receptivity tells us where there's general ripeness to the harvest or when it is still green. You take, for instance, Malaysia, Indonesia, Saudi Arabia. You know, these are difficult places. Iran, Iraq. These are difficult places right now. Okay? They are basically, I mean, you know, talk to the Lowe's and the Young's. I mean, we can't even get recognized there to openly function. We can't get speaker's permits. Why? Because there is such a religious bias in favor of Islam, and Christianity is simply, not easy to spread. Now, is God spread causing it to spread anyway? Yes. But it's less like being in, I mean, wouldn't you say, guys, you're in the 5 hours for 1 kilo orchard? Yeah. You take the Philippines. You take the potential in India. That's 5 kilos per hour. You take lots of Latin America where we, again, we're in a problem area still because we've only had one or two tools. And like the guy says, boy, you're taking those away. Well, we got to get these other tools in their kit. Send them back out to build an adobe place this time instead of a glass office structure. And you might be surprised what comes out. Okay, so you can contrast places like Israel where if you're caught proselyting, you're in jail. We would say, now look, that's resistant. We need to keep a presence there. We need to know what's going on. We need to watch for a shift. Japan, case in point, Japan, highly resistant society. Very difficult. Converts there, you know, the churches, Protestant churches in there doing their missions and things. I mean, they're hard won. Hard won. However, it's interesting because we'll see what happens. It'd be interesting to watch. The receptivity, the church growth gurus are predicting a shift in Japan in the next couple of years. I'll get to that in a moment, tell you why. Let me talk about the general receptivity. And we need to understand that it is not static. It's like the opening and closing of a door. And it is the general receptivity is affected by many factors. A couple of internal examples where this was affecting us, we didn't stop to think about it. We didn't know it, but it was. Booklet, you know, 1975 in Prophecy. Okay? That, during the time when it was out, was one of our top two or three most effective booklets. Absolutely incredible. You know, it's one of those scare us to death books. I mean, as a kid, Chris was a little older, but I know as a kid, I mean, I was afraid to read it. Because I was afraid not to read it. Afraid I'd go to hell if I didn't read it. Or I might get little. But I'd look at those pictures and I'd read there and I'd think, oh man, this is going to happen. And man, what if I've just, you know, what if I've been bad boy between then and the time that happens and I get left behind? Because I'd go to church. It didn't say it in the booklet, but I'd go to church and hear about how don't even come down and get your kids, you know. And I knew it was going to be a divine miracle if we happened to be in the same place at the same time. And if I wasn't in the same place, then they couldn't come get me. And so I knew it was either go everywhere mom and dad did, which was no fun, or take your chances, which... So anyway, it was all rolled together, and this booklet was a source of great consternation. But nonetheless, it was extremely effective. Many people were initially interested and came, you know, then expanded to other issues and grew interested and decided to act and were converted. So we cannot say it wasn't effective. How many of you would like to have that booklet as it is, as it was then, exactly as it was today in your arsenal? Anybody? Well, why not? It wouldn't be effective, would it? Not to mention that it wasn't what we should have been emphasizing. We'll leave that part of it out. We're just talking about sheer marketing effectiveness. During the period of time of the late 50s into the early 60s, when that booklet was being ordered as fast as we could print it, was a time when one of the best ways to make money was selling bomb shelters. In the schools, now we have earthquake drills, but in those days, it was bomb drills and civil defense drills. And everybody just knew that at any given point in time, Russia might just pop a nuke on us because we knew how bad they were, and McCarthy was making sure we didn't forget, and so on and so on and so on. And there was an issue of national receptivity, and that booklet played right smack dab in the middle of it. That national emphasis shifted away from that, and the booklet sounds ludicrous as an approach because it has shifted and it's no longer effective. You take a look in our, until recently, our funeral and our wedding. You ever find yourself doing a funeral and think, man, am I burying somebody here or am I arguing evolution? Say when you're marrying, I think, good night, what am I doing? What am I doing going on about creation versus evolution when I'm trying to get these two people married and it's, a, you know, and everybody's in the church anyway? Well, look back when those things were written. Look back at our, look back in the 60s. Look at our Whale of a Tale and For the Birds or whatever the other one was called. You know, I mean, beautiful booklets. I mean, popular, people were interested. And it led some people to make the jump into more spiritual issues and be drawn into God's church. Why? Evolution, historically, was an extremely hot religious issue. It still was at the latter ends of its being an issue in society. And we happened to be, you know, we capitalized on that. And consequently, it was tremendous. What happened? What would happen now if we made a big boy, you know, look at this, evolution, whale? Would it? Some people would ask for it, but it would be nowhere near as effective. Because the whole society has shifted away from that issue, and it simply would no. There's not a receptive audience. What do you talk about now? Ah, there are other things. There are other things that really have people's attention. Try AIDS. We wouldn't have done that in the 60s, but the receptivity has shifted, and it's there now. The Ukraine. That was a political factor. Communism falls. Ukraine opens up. They are hungry for anything Western, including any religious idea. They want to hear about it. Is everybody going to act on it? No. Will it stay the same? No. In fact, I feel that certain shifts have already begun to take place that will result in Ukraine closing, certainly moving from a plus five at least down to a zero, if not back to the negative scale. Interesting, Benin, where we have such tremendous response and growth. Benin was the Albania of Africa. Until the fall of communism, and then just like the Ukraine, they throw off the yoke, they go to a Western society, people start looking around saying, wow, what's out there? What have we missed? And I mean, you want to talk to somebody about anything Western, including religious ideas in Benin, and they'll listen. You get an audience. Will that stay that way? No, it will not. So, how do you know a receptive people when you see them? Here's two rules of thumb. This is general receptivity. First one. Ask yourself, look around and say, where are churches growing? Where are churches growing? That is merely going to be reflective of a general interest in religious material and spiritual things. Number two, these are very broad. They get much more specific, but I'm just giving you the broad starting point. Where are people changing? Change causes shifting on this scale. It can cause it either direction. Some changes tend to cause more positive shifts. Where are people changing? Such as, I'll give you some examples, cultural change. Where is the culture changing? Again, the church growth movement, it's incredible the degree to which they've developed some of these concepts, and they are engaged in an all-out acknowledge, I mean, when I say all-out and acknowledge, they haven't made an open public issue of it, but it is acknowledged that a war, a spiritual, a religious war, is going to take place across a band of Africa in the next 15 years. And they're gearing up for it. Because you've got a strong Muslim base in North Africa, fueled by the fundamentalist Islamic movements out of Iran and Iraq. You've got, to the south, you've got heavily, former colonies that are heavily Christianized. And a strong Christian base. Across West Africa, on through the central band, just sub-Sahara, you have a strong area of Africa that has still, until recently, been primarily animistic. The animistic religion is falling in the face of Westernization. The technology, the pleasurable, you know, the consumer items, etc., are beginning to undermine people's slavery to ideas of of spirits. And there is a crumbling taking place of religious and values, shall we say, in that part of Africa. And they have already identified that that vacuum, which is accelerating, is going to be filled. And it's either going to be filled by Islam or it's going to be filled by Christianity. And they fear that if they allow it to be filled by Islam, that Islam comes that far down, it's going to continue to just keep rolling right through. Because once it enters into the people groups of the Nilik, but the other African ethnic groups where you have related tribes, and they get a strong Islamic foothold in those tribal, which they have not had up to this point, that again, the concept of the people movement and the people influencing people, plus the aggressive nature of fundamentalistic Islam, is going to lead to a sweep of conversion to Islam right on down through, and they're afraid, where it might stop. So there's a whole strategic battle forming up to work that area of Africa to form a buffer to prevent the onslaught of Islam clear through the continent. I mean, they understand that cultural change causes a shift in the receptivity to spiritual things. Political change does the same thing. That's what we're looking at in Ukraine and places like Benin. Economic change. Of course, religious change itself. One thing you might not think about, but the status of scriptures. In other words, is the Bible available in the language, heart language of the people we're talking about? Migration patterns. Where you find incoming migration, you will tend to find higher receptivity. You can take a look at a church growth map of the United States, take a look at a demographic map of the United States, and they overlay right down the line. The states where you find the greatest influx of people, you will also find that is where churches are growing faster. And not just transfer growth, but conversion growth. That's important, because you could say, well, yeah, they're just moving in and going to another church. No, it's not that at all. The conversion rate is higher. Now, we have never done any studies like that, so I don't know, as far as God's church, whether we are dealing with that or not. The same, let's see, the degree of the influence of Christianity. In some places, where there may be a lot of people who have, you know, are Buddhist or whatever, but where Christianity is considered to be, a positive thing, the church will go much faster than in a similar area where Christianity is considered to be an evil thing. That's why we have better luck with Buddhists than, say, with Islam, because the Buddhists say, hey, you know, we like you too. Natural disasters. It's interesting. I said 6 months ago, I said, you know, if we take our efforts and channel them into the Mississippi Valley, we'd probably get a better return now than we would have in the past, or will a few years from now, because of the floods there. Simply because people are forced, and many of them have had their material possessions damaged or stripped away from them, and they are forced to think about things that are beyond the mere material. That alone creates a shift on the scale. It's interesting, after the earthquake, the day after, I was giving this to the Spanish, and I guess it wasn't. Yeah, it was. And on the news, they were talking about how on Sunday, that day before, the churches had been absolutely packed to the gills, and how the rededications that had taken place. One pastor was interviewed. He was talking about how many people were rededicated, and how many people made their commitment, and how many people, he was just elated. Well, it doesn't always last. Some of it's very short term, but others of it does extend over a period of time. And this makes the soil, you know, makes the difference between rocky soil and some of the less. The Falkland War. You can check statistics, and you will find that the Falkland War did something to the mindset of the average Argentinian. And the church growth rate was just simply, the line just goes like this, and all of a sudden just starts shooting up within a matter of a year or so of that Falkland War, and has continued. Guatemala, 1974-76, huge earthquake, church growth statistics, dramatic shift coinciding with that period of time. The Vietnamese immigrants, come to the United States, first 4 or 5 years, there were incredible receptivity. And you'd see Vietnamese churches with their sign in English and Vietnamese popping up all over creation. I was in Dallas, and I thought, good night, are there any Anglo churches left? You know, they seem to all be Korean or Vietnamese. It's interesting now, time has passed. Buddhism in the last few years has started to grow faster, once again, in the Vietnamese immigrant community than Christianity. There was a tremendous shift to the positive, and it is now gradually back to where it's probably slightly to the negative. You can look at the Holmes-Rahe or Holmes-Rahe stress scale, and where you find people that, as a group, tend to have the highest average on that scale, you will tend to find a higher degree of receptivity. Not a rule, but a tendency. Okay, so that's important to bear in mind. Now, boy, I thought I had an hour, and I don't, do I? I've got, is it 11:50? Good, excellent. 40 minutes, we can do it. All right, what are some of the things that get in our way? What are some things that can halt the growth in an area? One of the things that is the most damaging, and I think, personally, I think this afflicts us to a great degree, is what, I'll use the industry term, redemption and lift. Redemption and lift. To me, it's kind of a dumb term, but I don't have a better one. Okay. It's a two-step process. Starts with redemption, obviously, or regeneration, or conversion. Somebody's called and they're converted. Okay, let's go ahead and use their term, which would be redemption, or redeemed. Obviously, that's designed to start we're a new creature and start living by a new set of standards. In some cases, a whole new way of life. Is that good? Is that an unqualified good? A qualified good? Is it a qualified bad or an unqualified bad? Redemption. Where would you put that? Is there anything wrong with that at all? Could there be anything wrong with it? Is it good in every way? Sure. I mean, it's fantastic. Unqualified good. Redemption. All right. What is lift? Well, there's a couple different spin-off variations. One is benign and one is not. We'll start with the first one. When a person begins to live a new way by a new set of standards, they begin to bear fruit, right? It begins to be results of their thinking and of their living. Let's take someone who maybe was a bit lazy, maybe drank a little too much, couldn't hold a job, etc. Marriage has fallen apart. Kids are rebellious. God calls them. They begin to establish a relationship with Him. They begin to absorb certain standards and values which they didn't have before, and they begin to apply them. They begin to make an effort in their family. The kids begin to smile more. They begin to stand taller. They begin to be motivated in school. The wife and the husband have a new, certainly improved relationship. Maybe put the bottle away. Says, I don't need this. I have a higher power to help me. I don't need this alcohol in between us. That might lead to him showing up on time to work. It might lead to a value that God would have me put my whole heart into what I'm doing. It might lead to a decision that, you know, I've been 20 years and I'm out of high school and I've never had the slightest interest or made the slightest effort to learn any more than I knew then. What good was work? It was just something you had to do. But now I'd like to be the best at what I'm doing that I can be, and maybe even become something more than this, you know, whatever, fill in the blank, mundane thing he was doing to get by. What's going to happen in that person's life? What kind of fruit is going to be born? Liable to improve things, right? Your standard of living might even go up. Might end up changing his neighborhood. Could end up changing some friends. Right? For the better. And as a byproduct of having and embracing, becoming a different person, a person can, and hopefully will be to a certain degree, lifted to a higher plane of even physical existence as a result of the reflection of God's way than they were before. Now, is that we call lift? Is that a good thing or a bad thing? We call it good? All right, let's break it down then. Is it an unqualified good or a qualified good? I hear a chorus of qualifies. Why is it qualified? Why wouldn't it be unqualified? Well, two reasons. Like I said, one is benign and one is not. Wesley put it well in one of his sermons, where he lamented the fact, because the same thing was taking place as Methodism was just exploding across the land. And he was already at that point lamenting the fact, he said, how on earth? He said, Methodism, he said, is supposed to be and is a religion of the heart. Meaning, it's, you know, he was focusing on spiritual values, etc. He said, how on earth is it going to survive? I'm paraphrasing, obviously. Is it going to survive when it seems like the automatic result of living the right way creates this improvement and this lift, and that it seems that the typical result of that is that as that lift increases, so does the greed, so does focus on material things, so does a distraction and diversion from the goal, etc. And he said, with this improvement comes the squabbling, comes the bitterness, comes the greed, comes the lust, comes all the things, you know, the pride of life, all the things that we're supposed to avoid. And he said, how on earth are we supposed to survive this? He was identifying lift. He was identifying the evil or the wrong spin-off of what was intended or should be something that's positive. That was interesting, his conclusion. Later on in the sermon, he comes back to that again. He said, is there no hope? You know, is there nothing that can be done? He said, yes. He said, there is only one thing under God's heaven that will combat this, that will be an antidote. And he said, that is, if as a person is lifted higher through this process, that they give more. I found that interesting. This one professor was going on about tithing. And you know, we're having somewhat of a, I wouldn't say it's epidemic, I don't know, people don't talk openly, but I know it's a lot more common that people will question, well, how can you know, I can't see where tithing in the Bible is, you know, where we should be doing this, where we should be that, how can you say the second is this? Well, you can. But it was also interesting to me that this one professor, now he's an evangelical, but he's a very committed person. He says, you know, he said, tithing, this is his opinion, he said, this is my opinion, but he said, tithing, he said, that 10%, he said, that's for the poor people. He said, that's the minimum, that's the starting point. And then he went on to say, he said, my wife and I, he said, we made a covenant with the Lord. He said, in fact, we have a lot of our friends who do the same thing. He said, we practice graduated tithing. He said, we made a covenant with the Lord that whenever He gives us the blessing of an increase, that we will increase the percentage. He said, I'd hate to tell you right now what percentage I'm giving. He said, I won't. But he said, it scares me sometimes. He said, yet we just seem to be blessed and blessed. Well, I mean, I would hate to put that into our approach, because we've had difficulty in the past sometimes with trying to leverage God through physical things and covenants, you know. but it's interesting that in principle, what he's saying is what Wesley is doing. If as a people is blessed more, they will give back a greater portion. It undermines the lusts and the loss of focus, etc., that lift tends to bring with it. Well, I think we can look in our numbers and we can see that following 1972, and to a certain degree following the death of Mr. Armstrong, and when people feel a little disoriented by the necessary review of why we teach what we teach and the doctrinal changes that have resulted, that this has set in to a certain degree amongst some of our brethren. And when that is obvious, it halts the growth of the body. It just does. Now, I said that's the one that's not benign. There's another form of it that's rather benign, but it nonetheless is just as much a halt. Will cause halting just as much, and has to be combated. And this one, I think, is epidemic or endemic in our congregations. I don't think there's a congregation represented in this room that is not afflicted with this problem. Again, it's not a malignant evil one. It just is something that happens, and we need to be aware and take gentle, careful, timely steps to educate the brethren away from it. In fact, Mr. Nakata has already started long ago in principle, but we haven't gotten it down to where it's a fact at the congregational level yet. Take the same scenario. Redemption is an unqualified good. A person begins living God's way. We took the material side of it last time. Let's take the relational side of it this time. What happens? Well, as they become more and more committed and absorbed to being a part of the body, where's their focus? More and more in the body. Over a period of time, a greater portion of their time is spent on church things. A greater number of their relationships become, within the church. And as a result, the natural result is that they become, their bridges become less and less effective to the outside. That's why I said there's about a 3 to 5 year window for the average person. From the time they begin hearing and understanding, if they move along, if they're not one of these I've been reading for 20 years types and never done anything, but if they hear and they begin to move across that angle scale, and begin to consider internal problems, they begin to make decisions to act, they progress down the typical trail. It's generally a 3 to 7 year time period before they are fully within the church. Their relationships tend to be just naturally focused, their time to a greater degree. Their relatives all know what they believe and who they are. In the old days we would have hit it, but I'm talking in the current context, they would. Their coworkers know that they keep the Sabbath, they do these things. They've all had the opportunity to say, why do you do that? Now they've had the explanation, they understand. And basically they've had the impact they're going to have. And so the average church member becomes fairly ineffective in their current relational context after that period of time. So when you lose your influx of new people within that window, you shut yourself down as far as the natural bridges that God historically, 50% of us are here because of those bridges statistically. Now we may have used Plain Truth and the Correspondence Course as food, but the introduction of it, the encouraging to get involved, whatever, was through a kinship, employment-related, or friendship bridge. Who's the only ones worse than a person that's been around to the point where that window's closed? Second generation. It's abysmal. Because from the very beginning, all of our relationships basically were within the church. Our friendships, our hope, our focus. Especially, historically, with us, because the world was evil. The world, you stay away from that. If they do it, you go this way. You don't socialize. I'm probably one of the worst. Brought up in Imperial School, straight to Ambassador College, straight into the field. Hard to get much worse than that. But I'm having to make an effort to develop bridges later in life. Not so the purpose of I can go tell them about the truth, but for the purpose that the relationship is there, so if God wants to draw any of them, I can be a logical, and the first thing they think of is, oh, boy, he mirrors that same thing that I'm thinking about. Let me go see why he's that way. Let me go talk to him. Or if the people down the block are having difficulty and they need it, that they'd think to come to us. Whereas before then, I've never even known the neighbor's names. I never cared to. So, redemption and lift. Now, one of the things, I wish I had brought this book and I'd left it in Pasadena, but it talks about it described a typical situation where this benign form can be at play in the congregation. It talked about the book was talking about church growth and whether it said the first thing that was necessary was that the pastor had to really want the church to grow. And it gave some very interesting things that why some pastors, without even realizing it, put a halt on their growth for a couple of very interesting reasons that I won't get into at this point. Then the next thing it said was that the congregation has to really, truly want to grow. And it says many congregations, without meaning to, well, I'll tell you what, let me skip over that and let me just read it to you. If my briefcase is down there, and if sweetie, if you could go through my papers, a couple of those folders, it would be where the sermon was. Right over there on the wall. If you happen to find that, let me have it and I will quote it, because it's such an incredible quote, and I will ask you, do you see yourself? Do we see ourselves in that quote?
It'd be much better to do it that way than me trying to explain it. I'll go on and come back to it if she's able to find it. Okay, so we have the general improvement, and then we have the malignant kind where there's a turning away and that leads to the loss of focus, the eating and drinking with the drunkards, the smiting of fellow servants, etc. Okay, one other concept I want to bring in here. This is I'm changing courses now a little bit. These are some of the odds and ends in terms of strategy. Something we're using and will be helpful in certain parts of the world that you as a region deal with. And this is what's called in the industry three self concept. The three self concept. That's a selfish sounding term, but it's not talking about self-centeredness. It's talking about the word. And the three self concept is this: do not ever initiate anything. Tell me if we have lived within this or violated it. Do not ever initiate anything which cannot be, one, self-initiated. I use the term indigenously. Two, self-sustained. And three, self-propagated. Now that sounds brutal, doesn't it? When I first read that, I thought, boy, they are really out to lunch on that one. See, it'll be with, when you find the sermon notes that I gave Sabbath, it'll be mixed in, and it just at the top says your church can grow, quote. It's a whole page, single space. Self-initiated, self-sustained, and self-propagated. If we see, here's where we run into this problem. Let's take French Africa. We've never been able to do anything there. When this growth began happening, it was kind of like forcing us to realize that God was doing something whether we wanted him to or not. You know, he was just saying, I am willing to have children in this part of the world, and I'm having them. And they're converted. You go over there and look, and they've got God's Spirit, and they're obviously your brethren. Now, what do we do? Well, so we went to Mr. Dukakis. We said, Mr. Dukakis, we got a problem. He said, problem number one is God has indicated that he's calling people. We have brethren there, and they're continuing to roll in despite the fact we're doing nothing and haven't done anything. Now, that shouldn't be a problem, should it? But that was problem number one. Problem number two, Mr. Koch, is we can't afford to, we don't have the money to pump in there in terms of salaries, subsidies, etc., that would take to respond to them. Then they realize, third problem, or real problem, how is it that we've got the flow of God's Spirit and his desire, with determination that he's going to call and convert people, hooked up with money? Stop and think about it. That's like having law as the leash on grace. It's the other way around. It's grace that enables you to really fulfill the law. Here we've got money determining where God's Spirit can do what it wants to. We got something backwards there somewhere. That does not make sense. This three self concept has been very helpful because it helped us break through some old paradigms. One of which, again, went back to our racial and ethnic, subliminal values, in that you have to have an Israelite in charge of any Gentile. For that reason, we still have basically an expatriate German ministry. That's a series. Can't trust those guys. Better keep the Israelites in charge there. Across the way, the rule of thumb is Africans can't take care of themselves. You got to have a Westerner, or they'll go off into idol worship. Well, I'd say if they go off into idol worship, then we have a lack of conversion problem. But a converted African who is really converted and understands, has been discipled and taught, see, all the way through, taught to obey those things which I've commanded, is not going to go off into idol worship. Not if God's Spirit's in them. So, we said, okay, now, across the way in Anglophone Africa, we have churches, we've had a work, etc., and we are pumping currently just short of $1 million a year, $847,000 a year in subsidy to support the churches. We cannot grow. Is there receptivity across this imaginary line in Anglophone Africa? You bet there is. Ghana, places like that, very receptive. Are we growing? No. Why? Because we can't afford to. Something's wrong. Well, when you look at what we're paying our expatriate ministers, when you look at what it costs, you know, when you have an expatriate, you may be paying him $40,000, but you actually have to put out like $80,000 or $90,000. We got this thing. Here we are in Zambia. We sent a man in there. Now here he comes out of this culture, out of his own culture. We take him out of his culture, bring him to AC. That's westernizing real good. Get him a wife, send him back, and you gotta have, you know, when you send somebody and do this, you gotta have a car. Well, he never had in his culture, in his society, 90% of the people don't have cars. They never do, and they don't require them. The people in Benin, they want to buy land. It's 20 miles outside the city. I said, 20 miles? How are people going to get here? Oh, no worries. We go from country to country, just hop the taxi bus. I said, that's not a problem. What do you mean problem? We do it our whole life. They're happy to do that. 20 miles, no problem. Well, to me, see, that's a problem. I don't have a car. So we took him out of his culture, westernized him, sent him back. Now we've got to send him a car, so we'd lay out however many, $25,000, plus shipping, plus other, you know, nickel and diming. Get this brand new Toyota 4x over there. All of a sudden, whammo! Oh, $800 a month in Minex to pay for the insurance and the upkeep and the gas on that thing. They don't have any roads to speak of. I mean, it's like going through a mortar field to try to drive on their highways. So we have to fork out $800 a month. Doesn't have a place to live. Okay, got to get them a place to live. This rents are so high because the, you know, Westerners drive the rents up. So maybe we should buy a place. Okay, yeah, we got to buy a place. Find out into the diplomatic area of town, expatriate community, buy this place. 3 months later, the car's totaled. I'm thinking, what on earth? You know, here we are forking money out by the shovelful. We haven't made the first disciple. And now if we bind ourselves to the paradigm that we have to have a car, we're not going to have any disciples till we get them another one. This is ridiculous. Something has gone awry. Especially when he started out as part of a culture where he'd been happy with $100 a month and a few extra bucks for a taxi fares. Well, Karn Cather would put in this plan for French Africa, and it called for an outrageous subsidy, and he knew better than to ask for it. But at the same time, we have to do something for these people. I had just been studying some of these principles. We got together and said, let's talk about this. At first there was this frown, and pretty soon you could see his mind begin to go. And when he said, you know, he said, just on the little pittance tithes, which he said, I thought were almost didn't count. He said, why, if we didn't bring a man out and westernize him, if we sent trainers in and worked with them like Paul does, because I said, let's look at the Pauline model. How did Paul do it? Maybe there's something to be said. I ran across that in a book. It says, if you're trying to find an answer to a problem regarding church growth, try looking in the Bible. It says, somebody may have found the answer before you. I never thought of that, you know. This is 1994. What would they know about it? And there it was. So that's why we're sending in trainers, and they're going to go stay. I mean, these guys are going to have a college education. 3 years of up to 3 to 4 weeks at a crack 4 times a year. I mean, that's heavy stuff. Bring them in. What do? While they're gone from their jobs, we give their family what it costs. $50 a month. For some of them, it's all it takes to keep them at the standard of living where they are. We can give our pastors a healthy salary. Costs us $150 a month. And that includes the transportation allowance. It's not going to take us very much to have a full-time paid professional ministry who can devote themselves to nurturing and who can devote themselves to going out and preaching the gospel among their own people group where the bridges are there. And you know, when we get done working through the French language, which is the trade language, and we turn these guys loose to go back in their tribal language, it's going to start another whole crop of harvest going through. Absolutely incredible. Depending, again, obviously, depending on what level God wants, what size of congregation and numbers of people He wants at this time in that area. That'll be the guiding factor. But we won't be hindering it.
Do you ever send money in? Do you ever subsidize? Sure you do. For instance, if they put their little pittance together long enough, they could afford to buy a very much desired and needed piece of land in which to have, a visible presence. Okay, they would be able to do it their own. They could initiate it. It's a matter of time. We can pop $18,000 in there and buy them 3 or 4 acres. That may be more than they could have afforded, but hey, they'll use it to plant crops on. We haven't started something. We haven't initiated something they could initiate. We've just simply accelerated the timetable and made it possible for them to do it. It doesn't create an ongoing thing for us. We're able to pull back out and then keep going. They build a building now. If we went in and said, well, no, you've got to have ambassador quality. So we went in and put in Anderson Payne double glazed windows, and we put in, cedar shake. They don't have cedar there, so when it falls out, you guys know that problem. If we create the problem you had in your office down here, then they'd be replacing it like you had to. But if we let them build what they have and what they know to build, and we ask them to do it the best quality that you can, they'll have a perfectly suitable. When the roof starts to leak, they simply go get some more fronds, weave them together. I said, how long does those roofs last? I thought maybe 6 months or so, you know. He said, oh, we take care of them about 10 years. Good night, that's better than some of our commercial roofs, you know. They'll have wood. They'll use wood that won't be attracted to termites. You know, they know what to use. And it'll be suitable, it'll be good for them, it'll enable them to function and continue to grow. They can sustain it, and they can propagate it. What happens when, in Porto Novo, there's enough for a congregation? They're not stumped because they have to have an American-style ambassador college building with Pella double-glazed windows and a cedar-shaped roof. They can say, okay, guys, work party. You cut down the pole, you get the palm fronds. You know, we got to save up our money, we got to get a cement pad poured. Here they go, just like the Amish. Boom, raise up a church one afternoon. And they got a new church, and they can propagate that over and over and over, and it is not halted by the fact that we can't pump more hundreds of thousands of dollars into it. Unfortunately, in certain places where we've created this, the only way out is to retrench. And that's going to be painful. Therefore, we're not going to do it until we see and verify that this is what God wants us to do, and we see the degree to which he blesses our efforts there, and if it brings forth good fruit, then we'll look at what to do next. But in terms of an approach, in terms of the expansion of your own efforts, you know, in the ministry, if you create programs, if you create things which depend on you, you're going to just finally get yourself to where your growth and the growth of the congregation is halted. But the degree to which you help the people have a part and do what they can do, you will continue to grow and spread in your ability to serve. Let me go back now and read you this thing, back to Redemption and Lift. Tell me if this sounds like if this sounds like any congregation you've ever been around. I'm going to read a couple of paragraphs. Without faith, it is impossible to please God. Likewise, without faith, it is very difficult for churches to grow. Faith involves setting